Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Everyone is safe with all this severe winter weather. We're glad you're here for this special show. Ken God's Word is returning. He's been a guest discussing his UFOs in the Bible, magic in the Bible, and we'll be getting into his recent publication, The Fermi Paradox. And making her debut on Nightlight as a guest is Barbara DeLong. They co-authored Before Roswell, and it is now available. I think it's been out for maybe a couple weeks. Yeah, okay. Yeah, and you'll be seeing and hearing one or both of them on many shows to discuss this really neat book. And you'll see why we go analyze it over the next couple hours. It's available on Amazon. I think BarbaraDeLong.com. Ken, can you get it through your website?
Yep. I've got links on my website, DimensionFold.com.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's so on BarbaraDeLong.com in the I recommend section as well.
Okay. There you go. So I learned a lot from this, your book. Maybe we should discuss with the audience how the book originated, segue there into a bunch of other topics.
Well, that's really Ken's
good
story.
Good idea,
because,
so Barbara should probably start that.
Sure.
Okay, tell you what. I'll give a very brief word, and then I'll switch it over to you, because really what happened was when I met Barbara from coming on Nightlight to talk about some of my other books, I saw that she had a lot of material that was very interesting on her website, and I thought, hey, it would be really cool to turn some of this stuff into a book. So now I'll hand it over to Barbara, and she can discuss how she got this information.
Okay. My late husband was Patrick Cook, and He was quite well known. He was an authority on UFOs. He wrote the Bible UFO Connection, and he had the Matrix Radio website out there a lot. And he had a photographic memory, and he loved to research, and he did a lot of it. And when he passed away, I had to take his website down, and so I checked to see if everything, you know, if everything on his website was represented in his books. And the only two areas that were not in his books were his material on giants, so I brought that over and put that on my website, and his material on UFOs, so I brought that over and put it on my website. And it's gotten a lot of attention over the years, but, you know, I have read through it a couple times and found it interesting, but it wasn't my major focus until Ken got a hold of me, and now I'll pass it back to him.
All right. Yeah, so I took a look through Barbara's site, and I saw, there's a lot of cool stuff on there, but I guess one of the things that sort of piqued my interest first was the pages on UFOs. And I say pages because it's literally pages and pages on her website. And so I reached out to Barbara, and I said, well, what if we collaborate on this and turn it into a book? She thought it was a good idea, so that's what we did. And essentially we took all that material that Patrick had begun collecting, I don't know, many decades ago, I think. And I imagine it's been growing a little bit here and there as Barbara has been adding to it. And then when we started putting it into the book form, we added a few more items, particularly I brought in a little bit of the material from UFOs in the Bible book, and we also agreed on a couple of other instances that we wanted to include that we thought we were important. So that's kind of how that happened.
Okay, and you two have presented about 100 pages. You know, it's not a huge book, but you have many concise reports from obviously before Roswell to like caveman times.
Yeah, indeed.
It's a nice style. It's not like an overwhelming amount of information. It's just present. Yeah, there it is. And 1634. This guy in France reported in his journal. All this, and you move on to the the preceding sighting. So it's not it's well done. It captures your attention. Like I said, it's not just being flooded with information. It's a very insightful handbook, and I think you do mention patterns towards the end of the book. So maybe we can kind of start looking at some of the patterns as we get started.
Ken was asked a question someplace where he was interviewed on the book, and it was a really good question. I think that it's important for people to understand why he picked Roswell and went backwards from Roswell.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Because on Barbara's site, there's actually it actually comes into the current times a little bit further. In my opinion, Roswell is a pretty good place to define it. You could make the argument that it happened a little bit before that, but in 1947, there was a real sea change in the way that flying saucer phenomenon, as it was known then, was viewed and was sort of thought about in the public eye, as well as in the perception and the perspective of the government and the other official bodies, such as the Army and, you know, police forces and that kind of thing. Because what happened up until 1947, there had certainly been government involvement and Army involvement, especially during the Second World War. A lot of sightings occurred during the war, and many of them were made by fighter pilots, and they passed the information up through the chain of command, as, you know, one would do, as was appropriate. Not a big deal wasn't really made about it. You know, reports were filed, and there's probably who knows if there's still a storeroom somewhere with all those original reports. But that started to change in 1947 because what we saw with the Roswell incident was that there was an official report from the Army who investigated the crash in the Roswell Desert, and the Army actually came forward to the press and to the local newspaper, and the next day the newspaper ran some headlines, you know, flying saucer had crashed in the desert, and that was all perfectly normal up until that point, because that's kind of the way everything happened. You know, you would go talk to the papers and they would run it. But the following day was when things changed. And this might be why Lieutenant Philip Corso's book has the title that it has. And that is, of course, I'm referring to his book, The Day After Roswell. And he goes very in-depth into all of this other stuff that happened because that was triggered by this crash. But so now we're getting into the realm of the espionage and cover-ups and top secret stuff and subterfuge and misinformation and disinformation and suppression and all of this stuff. Which wasn't really a thing before the Roswell crash. Certainly there was, you know, the CIA and the FBI and they were doing that kind of, you know, that kind of activity, but they didn't really seem to care that much about flying saucers, and they were more interested in, James Bond kind of spy stuff. Which obviously you do have to, keep that in mind in terms of national security and that kind of thing. But suddenly, the powers that be decided that wreckage of a large piece of metal in a desert was something that warranted the concern of the national security folks, and so that was a really big change. Ever since then, you can't get a straight answer. And there's so many bad players on both sides of the debate, you know, whether you're a UFO believer or a denier, there's on both camps, there are all kinds of people who are, making stuff up and hiding stuff. So basically, there's a real lack of honesty and truth in the entire realm of ufology that really has been the case since 1947. But before 1947, that really wasn't the case. And so to look at the incidents that we chose to look at was basically stopping when the waters became too muddied. I don't know if it's possible to write a book about UFOs in modern times without being deceived, because there's just so much misinformation.
Okay, well, let's look at a case from 50 years earlier that I find really intriguing. Part of it, the 1897 airships were documented right down the river from me in Sistersville. There are also John Keel also mentions them in his Mothman Prophecies. So, you know, we're dealing with a different kind of craft, wreckage. The map you have of it does have a little bit of the same paths as the recent Chinese spy balloon. So, there was also at least one body associated with the ships that one of the ships that crashed in Texas.
Aurora.
And, Aurora. There is information about I think there's some of the metal in that case, and we have some of the the famous photo of General Corso and the pieces of metal on the floor of the office. So, Ken, you want to talk a little bit about the 1897 airship sightings?
For sure. So the thing that I find most interesting about this particular case is that it continues for about a 6-month period, not every single day or anything, but there are a couple of gaps in terms of there were no sightings for a week maybe, or a week or two here and there. But then there are these long strings where there was sighting after sighting in town after town, reported day after day. And it seems to be done so in a way where there seems that there was an actual single flying object that was moving across the country. So we pieced together a lot of those reports, and some of them had specific dates on them. Some of them only had the byline in terms of which local paper was covering it, and had more general dates, like, it was in May, but we don't necessarily know the day. So, due to using Google Maps, I was able to plot all of the locations and all of the dates that we were given, and then using extrapolation, we were able to basically identify the most likely path. Now, there's a fair bit of zigzagging around as well, so it's not necessarily Town A and Town B, but it's basically Town A and B were within a couple of days of each other, and you know, it's I can't tell you exactly the exact flight path, but we can say with fairly good certainty that the general pattern was that these skyships, or I should say this skyship, because really there was only one of them, and I, in my opinion, it's quite obvious that it was a single ship that was seen all throughout the country. And it showed up in California, in the Sacramento area first, and then it dipped down to San Diego, I think it was, and then back up the coast, and it was seen in British Columbia in my neck of the woods. They didn't give an exact location on that sighting. It was some fishermen in British Columbia. Most likely they were in the Vancouver area. But there, you know, it's a big province. It could have been a lot of different places. But at any rate, there was this sighting after California. It shows up in BC, and then over near Winnipeg, again in the prairies up in Canada. And those are the only two times we had reports of them showing up in Canada. Which doesn't necessarily tell you that much, because in 1897, sure, there was people in Canada, but, you know, there's the population of Canada has always been and will probably always be very minute in compared to the population of the United States. So it's not surprising that we would only see a couple of reports from Canada. Then it dips down into the Midwest. It goes through, if I start naming states, I'm just going to miss a bunch of them, so I'm not going to even try.
North Dakota and Iowa.
Yeah, it goes through North Dakota, Iowa, and then into, like, Kansas. Well, maybe over to Chicago.
Yeah.
It's hard to say exactly which one of those areas is first and second, but... So there was a little bit of guesswork in terms of some of that, but basically kind of zigzags around the Midwest and into the Great Lakes region, and then at some point makes its way down into Texas. And maybe I can let Barbara take over and tell us about the Texas sightings.
Oh, well, that one... is one of my favorites. This is the one where he flew into a windmill and crashed. Was that
yes.
it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, that's it.
There's so many here. But I think what fascinated me was with this one was that they thought originally there were six people in the vehicle or in the ship. And It did crash into a windmill. Apparently, they fixed it, sort of. It took off again, and then it crashed and burned. And even though they thought there were six people in it, they only found one body. What I find just delightful and so reflective of the times, they said that the pilot, the body, was a very small man, and so they picked it up, and they had a funeral for it. And they interviewed, we get most of our story from an interview with a 90-year-old woman, or 92-year-old, I forget, she was 90-something. And her parents didn't let her go to the crash site, but she did go to the funeral for the pilot. And they buried it in their cemetery. And many years later, in the 70s, I think, an organization, I think with the government that had to do with the UFOs, wanted to exhume the body, and the townspeople would not tell them where the body was. They wanted it to rest in peace, which I thought was, you know, it was so sweet. Sweet is the best word you can use. It's sort of like, you know, this was somebody that died in a crash, and we buried him, and he's at peace, and leave him alone. and they were never able to exhume the body. But I found it fascinating that the townspeople were not they did not appear to be frightened as much as they wanted to honor someone who had passed away. So it another time, and a more peaceful time, I do believe.
Okay. Yeah, there were six occupants.
They said they thought there were six, but when they went through the crash site, they only found one body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a number of the different sightings of that same ship had slightly different stories to tell. Like, they were all basically the same, but there's some variations in some of the details. And one of those was how many people were seen on the ship. Now, that's probably because this ship appeared to be sort of unusual in the fact that it was more like a ship, like almost like a flying ship, or almost like a boat that we would think of, in terms of having a deck and having a cabin kind of an area, which is
a cupola.
Which is pretty unusual in terms of UFOs. It's not the only one that's described this way. But it's sort of significant that this particular ship has a place where people basically come out and are standing on the deck, and oftentimes they were seen working. Many people saw two or three figures standing on the deck. Sometimes they seem to be engaged in repairing something, like something had broken on the ship. Sometimes it was obvious that there was something broken because either there was, sputtering fumes kind of thing, or the erratic navigational patterns. And sometimes there was actually the crew were seen to drop what appeared to be an anchor or some kind of like a hook. So, as though they were trawling for God knows what, but they seemed to be trying to pick something up. And so in a couple of the instances, the hook actually got snagged on something on the ground, and one of the crew members from the ship, in one case, climbed down the rope. And in another case, it was sort of described almost as though he were swimming in the air. So there's a lot of really weird things about this particular ship. But in general, and a couple other things too. So the descriptions of the people on board often included the fact that they were talking. So they were seen talking to each other, talking amongst themselves. And, of course, the people, the witnesses, could not understand their language. So they described it as a weird language. But, I mean, what does weird mean? It's just something that you can't understand. In at least one instance, one of the men on board was described as Asian-looking, which, again, is kind of interesting and sort of funny, but what is that? What is the cultural, interplay at work in 1897 when you have to realize there were, there was all kinds of cultural effects at work in North America around that time period, and particularly with Chinese immigrants who had been hired to come over and work on the railroads that were going across the country. So that's interesting. And then also there was, at times the people on board attempted to speak and communicate to the witnesses. And in those cases, presumably they were speaking English. We don't know for sure if all the witnesses only spoke English, There's a lot. Again, this is a time shortly after a lot of immigration. So there was, and these were in areas that had a lot of German immigrants and probably Swedish and Norwegian immigrants and all kinds of other immigrants from other places. So it doesn't necessarily hold true that they were speaking English, but that they seemed to be able to speak a language that was understood by some of the locals.
And you do have a passage about the two of the alien men were able to communicate with the property owners about drawing water from the well. So they had to have some basic understanding of speaking English. I thought that was,
it seems that way.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. But one of that craft had either a canvas or an aluminum siding. I thought that then you contrast that with the magnetic turbine that Gerard discussed last week from a 1910 part that was found in Marion, Ohio. That's some pretty unusual find falling from the sky. Then you get the more advanced metal from the Roswell crash. So it's almost like you can see an evolution of metal, the types of siding on the crafts, and some of it was metal.
Yeah, it is very interesting indeed. Now, I hate to bring this up because our book is about UFOs, so we're gonna say that this is an unidentified flying object. Well, obviously it's unidentified, and obviously it's flying. But what, in terms of what the origins of this craft were, one could speculate that, maybe a craft like that is not well suited for space travel. In fact, in many of the descriptions, it seems to be rely on buoyancy, much as a dirigible or a blimp would. But the funny thing about that is, and it also looks a lot like a dirigible or a Zeppelin, but the technology for Zeppelins and dirigible was not really quite there yet. Like, it followed shortly after. So one could even speculate that the Zeppelin industry was spurred on by the arrival of this ship, and that basically we stole the technology, or at least got the ideas from watching this ship. That would be one way of interpreting that. Another way would be that somebody had already been developing it, but it was a top secret thing and nobody knew about it. However, that's a little bit difficult in terms of the timeline and the success rates of the early development of the dirigible of Zeppelins, because it's quite well documented in terms of who the inventors of these types of ships were, when they did them, and what kind of results they were getting. And generally, we're talking about 20 years later, so around 1915 to 1925 was when, there was more development around this type of technology. But these guys had really bad luck that it was difficult. They were up against a very difficult task. It was almost the equivalent of you know, the NASA and the moon landing mission in terms of we're trying to do something that man has only ever dreamed of. And so in the early 1900s, a lot of people tried their hand at flying machines, a lot of different ways, obviously, you know, the Wright brothers and all that. But in terms of these lighter than aircraft that had were basically buoyant and used like almost like a hydrogen or helium situation to provide lift, this is kind of what these crafts sound like. And in the up until about 19, I'm going to get it wrong if I try to say the right year, but in the 1920s, somewhere, was the first time anybody was documented in being able to make this flight work for more than a couple of yards without crashing. So like the first time somebody was able to travel, say, a mile, was a long time after this 1897 uh-huh. sighting. Well, the 1897 guys traveled for thousands of miles. Like, I'm going to, off the top of my head, I'll say at least 4,000 miles, because they went from California all the way up into Canada, across, and then back down. It was a heck of a trip. There's no way that anybody 20 years later could even come close to that until many, many years later, when finally the Germans were able to do the first transcontinental or transatlantic flights of the Zeppelin, which of course ended tragically with the crash of the
Hindenburg.
What's it called? The Hindenburg, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one of the early sections of your book. I thought there were so many things. We could tie it in to other various passages from, just say the Exodus. We'll do that later in the show. But, when you look at the Aurora case or, Moses following the pillar of fire, what at those two time periods flew other than birds?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Exodus of Moses was roughly 1300 BC. There was nothing. There was no kind of technology 3,000 years ago that could do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did the people say? I thought that was really well done section you had there.
There has to be. I have to get this piece of trivia in here because it's the best piece of trivia I've had to play with forever. 1917, fighter pilot Baron Manfred von Richtenfern, also known as the Red Baron, not only shot down 80 enemy planes for the Germans during World War I, but he was the first human in history to shoot down an alien spaceship. And that came from an interview with somebody who saw it, or was there, I believe. So that, I mean, how cool that the Red Baron shot down the first spaceship.
That guy was all that and a bag of chips.
I did not know that until I read Before Roswell. That is fascinating trivia.
Well, hey. I mean, there's a great deal I like in the book.
Yeah.
But when I hit that one, it was like, holy mackerel. This And then I realized that it was from an interview, and it was for real. And it's not gonna make any game show or anything like that. But I just think it's the coolest piece of trivia we've got. And every time I look at it, I keep hearing Snoopy and the Red Baron. So.
Maybe someday it will show up on Jeopardy.
who is the Red Baron, Alex?
Or who was the first fighter pilot to shoot down a UFO?
That's right. Yeah. Well, he'll have to give it to you if you answer like that.
Yeah, but I can't. I probably won't be able to answer anything else. So it's going to be a huge stroke of luck for that to hit me before I get, shown up as being an idiot. So
whoever goes home with $400.
I'll take it. Just, seriously, to just put, I think one of the things this book does that I find just so terrific is it makes what's happened in history not only comfortable to read, but insightful and educational. And, it's not
mm-hmm.
pounding information that you have to remember by rote memory, but it's showing you that our history as it stands now in history books is boring as it can possibly be. And then you have all of this that is a part of history as well that would people's ears would perk up and they'd be interested in it. And what I love is it's not 400 pages, it's an easy read, and it informs you not only that, but there are major points in history that we cover that are not covered in history books that really should be. And,
even within the periods that we do, learn about in school, particularly Rome and Greece, those are always big topics.
Yeah.
But, I'm just trying to count how many we have here from the Roman Empire. It's at least five pages. There was a ton of UFO sightings in ancient Rome. But that has been conveniently taken out of the record. Even when it happens to be the actual, the very characters that we do, such as, the actual Caesar, the emperors, and various
yeah.
other famous people that are covered in the history books, such as, what's the name of that, the general, I'm trying to find it.
That was the Cassius. And Brutus, or Pompey.
Yeah, Pompey. Yeah, that's right. And several other guys that you would recognize from the history books, but you didn't hear this particular story. And that's quite interesting, especially considering that some of these sightings really played a pivotal role in turning history. Because there was the one where they saw something in the sky, which is generally when people do talk about it, they falsely state that it was perceived to be a cross.
Oh, the Battle of Milvern Bridge was
Constantine. Yeah, which is interesting because I don't know. I mean, so again, here, even way back then, you can't get away from the politics and the spin because there are several different versions to that in terms of whether he saw a cross or whether he saw just a bright light, but he saw something. So the descriptions themselves are somewhat there's some controversy around how it was described, but he saw something, and it spurred them on to win the battle. which was became a, you know, a little pivotal moment in terms of a decisive battle for Rome and expanding their empire.
Well, you know, Ken, too, as a, I'm a school teacher, and to be honest with you, if I was teaching history to a bunch of teenagers, I would teach the history around the UFO sightings, and you would get kids interested in it. You know, this was in this time period, this is what was happening with UFOs. And in this period of time, this is what was happening with UFOs. And to weave history into something that we could relate to today would have made history come alive for kids, as opposed to all of the dusty stuff we were forced to teach them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll take this as an opportunity to sidetrack a little bit onto the Sumerian mythology.
Sure.
Because, you know, about 50 years ago, we discovered a huge number of clay tablets in what is currently Iraq, and like thousands of these tablets, and a lot of people started trying to decipher them. And so we have this vast treasure trove of, you know, we call it mythology, but in terms of what is it really? Is it history? A lot of it reads like history. There's some of it is probably fiction. And there's all kinds of other, you know, record keeping and, you know, I don't know, all kinds of other documents. In fact, I think there was even a complaint letter to a vendor saying that, you know, he purchased this item and it sucks and he wants his money back. So these are all the kinds of documents that we found. And scholars began poring over them. And we have now a vast wealth of these documents have already been translated into English. Now, many people will be familiar with Zechariah Sitchin, who was really interested in these documents, and he did a fair bit of speculation, which may or may not be supported by those documents. It's hard to tell because, of course, Sitchin never gave references and didn't tell you which tablet or which story he was referring to. So I took the liberty of digging into those stories myself, and I've been able to read the English translations that many of the those who have gone before us have have done a terrific job of adapting those and translating them into English, even within that framework. So I'm not doing anything weird or like retranslating, or I don't claim to speak Sumerian or Babylonian, but when you read these texts, these stories, I read them as though they're historical documents, or like somebody is telling the story of what happened, because they clearly are. They're extremely narrative in their style. Many scholars will lead you to believe that they are hymns of praise and things like this, and religious things with religious overtones, which I don't think is accurate, although there are certain sections that sort of read like a hymn of praise, but maybe they're just corporate ass-kissing. I don't get religion out of these books. I get history, and I get a lot of science. And the science that comes up in these books matches almost precisely with the science that I see in that I talk about in my other book, UFOs in the Bible, where there's a lot of high tech stuff that seems like they're talking about some kind of high tech device. So the Sumerians and the ancient Hebrews were seeing UFOs, or in the case of the Sumerians, it wasn't even about a UFO. It was about the people who came to Earth. Like, they're very explicit that these are alien beings that came to Earth. And then they, you know, they interacted with the whoever was here at the time, and they actually created humans, which is similar to what the Bible says, because it's different, but it's similar in a way where the Elohim were now on Earth, and then they created humans. They breathed, they created man in his own image. But the him there is actually our. So the Elohim, which is a plural, were creating man in their own image. And so there's all, so there's the story that is consistent in the mythology, but it's really a history story. And that's some history that is certainly left out of the history lessons at school, but is probably the most important question that history can address. And yet historians essentially don't think that they have that information because they don't even try to answer the question of where did we come from, which is really one of the most fundamental questions that all humans ask.
Ken, since you were just talking about some of these UFO, you know, the UFO biblical connection, it's some of the stories in Before Roswell actually seem like you have the same characters, or at least the same scenario, where you know, you have, I think one example is Paul on his on the road to Damascus, and there are a couple what he calls angels that talk to him, and then they like suddenly evaporate by him on, you know, just this lonely stretch of road. You have people later, centuries later, almost reporting the same type of situation where, you know, they, the normal humans thought they were talking to other humans, then all of a sudden they aren't there. Are we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, are we dealing with this? You know, in the 1880s, most people aren't thinking of ETs. Are we dealing with like the same type of situation? You know, just different words are used for something that, for events that are separated by, you know, maybe a millennia or millennium.
Well, I think most likely, yes, because they are described essentially the same way. You know, is there room for there being differences in their descriptions? Yes, sometimes. You know, if you go back into the let's talk about the Hebrew Bible a little bit more, because the you know, we have this understanding that that the Bible talks about angels. Well, the New Testament does talk about angels. Because the New Testament is written in Greek, and the word angel, angelos, is a Greek word that the society and the culture at the time was heavily influenced by Greek thought, as well as Greek theology or mythology or whatever you want to call it. But there was the whole Greek pantheon, which was very highly influential on the culture of its day. But before all that, in the milieu of the ancient Hebrews, there was not a concept of an angelic being from another dimension, nor was there the idea of the fallen angels and the devil and Satan and all this stuff that we kind of use to interpret the Bible. Although there are hints of some of those concepts, like sort of early stages, that's not really how they perceived the world. And so when you look at the original Hebrew writings and you sort of strip off some of these assumptions that we bring to the table, you realize that it's actually not talking about an angel. So a good example here is with Jacob. Jacob was on a trip, and everything was camping in those days almost. You'd be traveling through the countryside with your flocks and herds and your family, right. And then you'd stop and set up your tents. And so one day he did this, and he noticed that across the canyon, on the other side of the river, there was another camp over there. Now, keep in mind, Jacob had a large retinue. He had a huge family with, like, extended family and in-laws and outlaws and many, many servants and thousands of head of livestock. So he was, when we say a camp, think more like an army camp in like a Tolkien movie rather than, you know, hey, we're going camping this weekend. And so in this story, this is what the word means. And when Jacob stopped, he said, hey, look at this camp over here. There's an encampment of people. And he called them Acharim, which is a Hebrew word, which means others, the others. So he was very explicit that these people were, if they were people, they were not his kind of people. They were some other kind of people. So that could be that they were aliens in the land, which is another thing that the Bible talks a lot about, is the aliens in the land. But again, it's hard to determine whether they're just talking about a different tribe or a different kind of, maybe it's a genetic or a racial thing. We don't really know. Most of the time. But it's clear that Jacob saw these others, and the name of it, so a lot of times Jacob would call the place where something significant happened, he would put a name on the place, and that name would stick. And so this place was called Two Camps. I can't remember how to say it in Hebrew off the top of my head. Then the following day, again, he came into a closer contact with one of these beings. So a few miles down the road, he runs into one of these guys. And this time, he has a close encounter where they communicate, and they actually have a wrestling match. And Jacob is permanently wounded and walks with a limp from now on, which is... In my UFOs in the Bible, I talk about that falling under the category of the Hynek scale as a close encounter of the second kind, because there's physical evidence left behind. Another piece of physical evidence was for that particular spot was the spot, the name that Jacob assigned to that spot was Beth-El, house of, we like to think that it's house of God. But El does not mean God. Beth does mean house. So it means house of El. But the El is short for the Elohim. Well, the Elohim, of course, is a race. It's a group of people. So when we saw the previous day, he called this group the Acharim and noticed that there's a lot of them. And now he comes against one of them. And he now refers to him as an Elohim. Well, the word El in Hebrew actually means two, as though like I'm going to the store now. The word two as a root word with the suffix ohim on the end means the two people. So the kind of implied meaning there is that they're the people who came to Earth. Now, that's a little bit of a logical stretch. It's not exactly saying that, but the word strongly implies it. But the other interesting thing is that Bethel is still a known spot. It has always been a spiritual hotspot. People go there today on pilgrimages because they want to see the spot where these events happened. The other name for this event, kind of the more common name for it, is Jacob's Ladder, which is, of course, a very famous story that even if you never read the Bible, you would probably have heard the story where apparently Jacob, not only did he wrestle with one of these guys, he also saw a flying object come down, and there were otherworldly beings coming in and out of this object in the sky. He refers to them as ascending and descending. And it's not a ladder. The word ladder does not appear in the Hebrew, nor does the word stairs. It's not completely clear, but it's the word that they use is more similar to a ramp, which of course is a classic UFO motif. You know, a ship lands, a ramp comes out, and people are coming in, out and in.
Right.
You can't get more classic tropey UFO than the story of Jacob's Ladder.
Okay, Barbara, since Ken just gave us some of the authority figures from the Old Testament, you also incorporate some of the founding fathers. What were their views of life from space?
Well, I'm not so sure they quite said it that way, but I know that John Adams, Ben Franklin, a lot of them were very aware that we're not alone, that there have to be other cultures out there. You know, they weren't really necessarily, I don't believe, talking aliens as much as they were talking, other planets having civilizations on them. So I think that, especially Ben Franklin. I mean, come on. I mean, among other things, he was a dirty old man. But, he was. He was definitely... somebody who strived to celebrate as much as he could and did. He was also a member of a lot of esoteric societies and all sorts of stuff. So he definitely, probably if you had talked about aliens, he would have thought that was a great idea. John Adams for sure did. And George Washington... Of course, during the Revolutionary War, there's a story of him going into the woods and meditating and seeing a being, whether it was an angel or an alien, who knows, because they've been used interchangeably now for so long, it's hard to tell. But he was given the message that he would win the battles, and he went on to do just that. So that there have been experiences, certainly, by our early fathers, and they're probably the women too, but apparently history just cared about the men for a certain amount of time, so the women don't get their say-so in there, but it's true. They write about the fathers, but not the mothers, so to speak. But there were...
Oh.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to... on page 70, you have in 1789, American founding father John Adams financed a publication entitled A Short Account of the Solar System and Comets in General. The document outlined the national security implications of comets, detailing the probabilities of potential effects such as fires and floods should the comet strike Earth. The book explained that these comets were quite possibly inhabited by intelligent beings who might be a problem because they were almost certainly more knowledgeable about the universe than people on Earth. I thought that was, you know, one of those really neat examples of how forward-thinking, you know, the founding fathers were, started getting into, national ideas about national security with comets. It's just, they seemed way ahead of their time.
Well, I would agree with you. I think there, I think there are a lot of those instances that people have sort of passed by and not paid attention to. Excuse me, I'm choking here, so let me get some water.
Yeah. Okay, give her a second to get her sinuses under control. Okay, and you know, we can get into the sciences and how there are a lot of leading scientists like Pliny the Elder, Leonardo, Thomas Jefferson, Halley, people at the Royal Observatory. Ken, what do these scientists lend to the study of UFOs and ETs.
I mean, obviously there's some credibility attached to, the label, having the label of scientist. And I think that is and sometimes maybe played up a little bit, but there is good reason for it because somebody who is trained in science has been has been exposed to a certain level of rigor in terms of evidentiary. Think of it would be like if somebody's a lawyer, then you know they know how to make an argument. You don't necessarily know that they're going to be telling the truth, but you do know that they understand how logic works and how to make an argument and how to attempt to prove a point. And science is similar in a way, also quite different in another way, but there is a certain type of academic thought process and evidentiary process and experimental process that is involved in science. And, not to say that a scientist cannot make a wild claim, but when he does, he is quickly refuted. And in fact, maybe too quickly refuted, because right now we have many times we run into the opposite problem where somebody has found something that's scientifically valid, but the academic community is quick to label him as pseudoscience or you know, whatever other their nice name calling bullying
right.
word of the day is that they choose. But there's at least there is some kind of training and experience behind every scientist who is able to study in any scientific discipline, be that chemistry or physics or astronomy or whatever. So so that's one thing. And then when it comes down to guys like Halley, who, of course, we recognize his name from the famous Halley's Comet. He didn't invent Halley's Comet, of course, but he was one of the first people to notice this comet, and to take measurements, scientifically measuring its trajectory in such a way that he was able to predict when it would return. And, you know, this is something that science is really good at doing, is taking measurements and then extrapolating and using calculations and using math in order to predict the future. They've been doing this since the time of the Sumerians, at least, and probably even going back as far as probably 10,000 BC, when you have things that are now being discovered, sites like Göbekli Tepe, and some even older sites in Turkey and the area around there, where people were apparently able to do advanced astronomy, even including predicting eclipses, and like doing very advanced math that I would not even try to do using my super laptop with spreadsheets and computers. And I mean, I'm a computer science and I know how to write programs. I wouldn't even want to try to tackle trying to predict, do predictive things of astronomical cyclic events that happen in the thousands of years. You know, I can predict when the next full moon will be. I'll take that on. That's something I can calculate. But our ancient ancestors were doing very advanced stuff. And it makes you wonder how they were able to do that.
Okay. Barbara, are you feeling better?
Yeah, I'm back. Ken, could you speak a little bit about the Middle Ages and those sightings they had in the Middle Ages where they saw an object and the plague broke out and they saw the men with black coats and scythes? I found that fascinating.
I like that. Yeah, that was an interesting section you two did.
Well, yeah, and that sort of ties in to the comet theory, that the comment that was it Ben Franklin that, or no, Adams?
John Adams.
Made about the, yeah, John Adams published that paper on comets, and then we have you know, these supposed correlations between outbreaks and meteors or meteorites crashing, and so I actually delve into that a little bit in my other book, Fermi's Paradox is BS. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say the full title on here.
Just stick with BS.
If BS is fine. You guys know what it means, so you know how to Google this book, or just look on my website. Basically, in that book, I look at more of the scientific bent. The real question I'm proposing there is there any kind of evidence for life in space or for extraterrestrial life? And I'm not necessarily assuming that there is, but I'm looking at the scientific fields that we have access to, including biology, chemistry, astronomy, and physics. And one of the things that we look at in there is comets and meteorites. and what we have learned about them, and what you probably don't know because they're not telling us about some of the things that they have identified inside crashed meteorites that have landed on Earth. So if you want more information on that, get my other book, Fermi's Paradox of BS. But all I'll say right now is that, John Adams was onto something because he indicated that there was a, he felt that it was possible, if not probable, that these comets contained life. Well, scientifically speaking, they do. And so that's covered in that book as well.
I read someplace recently, and I don't know where it was, but that Earth, when it was created, when it all came together and from pieces of other planets that had kind of blended together, and then it was just a hot mess of burning stuff that originally, when Earth formed, there was no water here, and the water came from comets and meteors striking the Earth and bringing the water with them.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's actually been proven now, and just in the last few years. This is how new this science is that we're just finding out a lot of information just now, that because of we have made so many advancements in space technology in the last 10 years even, but also going back in terms of some of the earlier launches, such as the Voyager mission and some of these other ones, where we've sent out these space probes into the far reaches of space. And they're actually, the Voyagers, there's two of them, the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and they've actually both gone so far that they're now outside the realm of what we would officially call our solar system. And they are out in deep space, and they're examining and finding out some very strange information. No, they haven't run into any alien technologies or civilizations or, space, living space plasma or anything like that. Sort of. So I talk about some of that stuff in there, too. The one thing that is definitely, definitely true is that there's tons of water out in space, which nobody really knew even 10 years ago. There was some speculation, but really, if you had asked anyone on the street even a couple of years ago, well, even now maybe, if you ask the average person on the street, is there water in space? Most people probably think, no, there isn't. And that was also the case in terms of scientists, up until just a few years ago, nobody knew that water was out there. It has now been confirmed that there's 50 times the amount of, so if you take all the water that's on Earth, including our oceans and our ice and our rain and rivers and streams and all that, multiply that by 50, that's how much water they've already found in our own solar system. Most of that being on other planets, in asteroids, and in most of the moons, like the moons of Jupiter and moons of Saturn. So there's water everywhere. It's shooting around. It's not just tied up on a planet, because these asteroids and comets, which contain huge quantities of water, are always flying past and smashing into everything. If you look at the moon and you can see craters all over the thing, those same craters are present on Earth. We just can't see them because there's oceans and trees in the way. But that's how our water got here.
Okay. Since we're, we are kind of talking a little bit about, we had just been speaking about the Middle Ages. You do cover one of my favorite medieval topics, the Black Plague, reports from this period feature strange cigar-like objects flying low through the sky and dispersing noxious mists. Yeah, that's kind of like it would be some kind of water-based type solution. Soon after these objects passed by, plague would break out in that area. Other features from this period, similar to modern UFO reports, include sightings of mysterious men in black-like scythe-wielding reapers clad in black hoods and robes and mysteriously slaughtered cattle and other animals. 1 year before an outbreak of plague, a column of fire was seen over the Pope's palace in Avignon. Blazing comets were seen numerous times in the heavens. That little paragraph goes on. So there's, these cigar-like shape craft are hovering over Western Europe, and they have some kind of soluble liquid type thing that is spraying. So where are they filling their cargo holds to spray this solution? They had to get some of the stuff from space if they did really come from outer space.
Yeah. I mean, one way of interpreting that would be that, they are simply just comets or, asteroids that are flying through our atmosphere. They would look roughly cigar-shaped because of this, the streaking. If you see a comet flying through the air, it looks like a streak of fire. So, it's sort of vaguely cigar-shaped. Especially, it might also be trailing smoke, which makes it look even more like a cigar. So, it's hard to say whether, with any certainty, whether all of these sightings might be a flying craft, or whether some of them might be more of a comet or some kind of astronomical event. But in any case, yeah, you're right. There would have to be water involved in dispersing, the whatever chemical makeup. I hate to use the word chemical because I think to most people that means, some kind of factory-made product like fertilizer or, poison or something like that. But really, a chemical is an all natural matter is made of chemicals. Chemicals are just the elements. So I'm not necessarily trying to say that somebody has created a poison and sent it down. But I'm also not ruling that out. But if it were strictly natural water, water-based components from outer space, that could easily just be a comet, because that's really what comets are, is chunks of ice and rock and other elements. And we've found heavy metals such as lead and mercury and those types of metals. Those exist in asteroids. It's only a matter of time before we start mining the asteroids. There's abundant elements of all sorts. And that's going to also include radioactive material, uranium and stuff like that. So there's all kinds of things that are in space and in asteroids and already on Earth in abundance that you don't necessarily want to be breathing. We have, aside from biological viruses and whatnot, just the fact that there's all kinds of elements that will interact in a negative way if you get them into your sinuses or your nasal passages or your lungs. Anybody who's ever worked in construction will know about the dangers of some of the materials that they use there. I've made a lot of strides in terms of making the job sites more safe in terms of the materials that are used. But, we used to use a lot of materials in construction that are now considered highly hazardous, basically illegal. And if you find them, you have to spend a lot of money that you probably don't have to remediate these things. Asbestos, obviously, but there are other ones. Even in the paint that we used to use, there were a lot of kind of bad things in there that were not super healthy to be around, and yet we're slapping it all over our walls. I guess the question was, what this correlation could be, and could it have caused the Black Plague? Well, sure, it could have, and it could have been a virus. It could have been a bacteria. We have found viruses. We found traces that indicate that viruses and bacteria could exist in space. We found evidence that bacteria probably has existed in space. I'm not going to make the claim right now that it still does, although I personally think it does, but I don't have evidence for that. But there's all kinds of things that can cause a plague.
Yeah, and you also cover in Fermi's paradox the possibility that the Spanish flu may have had some type of outer space origin.
Yep, for sure. I just thought of this now. This is brand new off the burner. There's lots of cases in religion where the gods are punishing man. Many times that takes the form of a plague of some kind. The most obvious example is the Great Flood of Noah, which, if you think about it, could also be an incoming comet, because we know that comets are where Earth gets most of its water from, and we know that during the Great Flood, the ocean levels rose significantly. So that is just put two and two together, and there's a very good chance that a substantial amount of water was brought in at that time on a sizable comet, and it wiped out much of the life on Earth. We typically assume that's because they drowned, but it doesn't actually explicitly state that. So there may also have been a component of some kind of a plague or, a chemical-based extermination due to non-breathability of the air. We don't really have a ton of details in the flood accounts. And I say accounts because flood accounts exist worldwide in every mythology that you can think of.
Right.
And they all have a couple of the same factors, but they also all have a lot of different details, too. But they're none of them really go into a huge amount of detail as to really what was happening scientifically, probably because the survivors didn't know. There may have been other people around at the time who did know, but they didn't survive to write to tell the tale.
Okay. Ken, since you just talk a little bit about the flood story, there was one of your examples from back to before Roswell with the Durham Abbey, and an abbot died in 1320, and all I guess over the during the funeral, a light shined down on his grave. That seems like whatever that was, it's faith based event, or if it's actual UFO, do you feel that some of these UFO encounters are related to specific events, like the death of this abbot? Do they show up for like certain occasions? Just happens to be, they're here on a certain day because that's how long it took them to fly from Zeta Reticuli, and they really didn't have a ETA. What do you think about that?
I have
Mark?
Some thoughts, but maybe I should let Barbara have a turn here.
Okay.
Well, no, before I choke to death, yes, it's sinuses. I think that instance kind of corresponds to the Fatima experience, where at one of the apparitions, they saw what appeared to be a silver disc, a saucer, whatever, but hundreds, thousands of people saw it, and nobody ever, because there was so much going on with Their Lady in White, and then they called it the Virgin Mary, and the rainfall of the rose petals and stuff. I mean, but woven into all of that religious experience was a UFO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what I started the show by saying, towards the end of the book, you do have a reference to patterns. I think with the hundreds of examples that Patrick collected, and as well as what you two added to your book, the reader can maybe start seeing some of these possible patterns without you two providing your own commentary, but it does seem like there is something about religious events. Maybe you could actually, this Durham Abbey example in Fatima, or the Star of Bethlehem. You present enough information where I don't know, maybe the readers will start realizing, these crafts are showing up for occasions.
or the occasion is created after they show up.
Well, could,
I mean,
could be.
I mean, as far as the one at Durham, I mean, that could be, it could be ball lightning. It could be pardon the expression, but swamp gas, because, you know, when that seeps up out of the ground, I hate to say it, but I've seen swamp gas. and there really is such a thing. And it is illuminated, and it does look really spooky. And it could have easily been that, even without J.L. and Hynek around. But I think that it becomes hard when you know about UFO and the new UFO phenomena, and then you see a lot of these physical conditions that really do exist, and you kind of want to make them all UFOs, but they aren't. And I think the cool thing about the book is we've kept it really to sightings that we really believe were UFOs, and were not some sort of swamp gas rising up out of the ground.
Okay. Well,
I think that's a good point. Like, you know, you made a couple of really good points there. One, sometimes the event is interpreted retrospectively and given significance, which I think is certainly the case in some of these. But on the other hand, there is a more recognizable pattern in the modern times, which we don't cover in this particular book. But there is a correlation between UFO sightings and I'm not sure how to say it exactly, but
podcasters,
like podcasters, yeah, with podcasters. And with nuclear development. So most of the nuclear sites, especially in the early days, United States nuclear weapons program, every single major site where there were nuclear warheads became a hotspot for UFO activity. So that could mean several things. That could mean that, you know, these sightings were human technology that was either friendly or spy-based and trying to get more information about this, or trying to protect the site. Who knows? That's one way you could interpret it. Or somehow, if there were aliens involved, that the aliens somehow knew about what was going on the ground. And, you know, in many of these, many of the abductee stories you hear, just close encounters which involve communication. A very common theme is the theme of world peace, and that the aliens are here to warn us before we blow ourselves up, kind of a thing, which is quite reasonable if you think about it. If there are aliens, they probably don't want to get blown up either. And if they happen to be living anywhere near us, which they seem to be, because they're near enough to know what's going on. So that, to me, implies that there's some kind of orbital, I'm not going to say facility necessarily, but there's some bit of truth to this ancient mythological concept of the Watchers, where there are some beings somewhere out beyond Earth who are keeping an eye on humanity.
Well, I think the new thing is that they're looking at Alaska and a lot of the mountain ranges there and saying some of them really do contain alien strongholds. So, you know, they've let Mount Shasta go. Some organization said that they had all aliens had all left the planet because they were afraid we were going to blow it up, and that the Mount Shasta was the last bastion of them, and they had left. And recently I've read a lot of material about their thinking that there are a lot of alien bases around a lot of the mountain ranges in Alaska that you know, are so far away from everything that there's no human presence there at all, and that's where the aliens have relocated. So I don't know.
I'm not going to say that I 100% disbelieve that, because it's entirely possible to hide away. And especially if the vehicles that you have are amphibious, which, as we see in our book, many sightings confirm that oftentimes UFOs can go underwater or can emerge from underwater. And this kind of brings us back to the Operation High Jump as a classic example, where, you know, supposedly there's an underground base under Antarctica. But, you know, I haven't seen any evidence that directly supports that I find to be credible. I've seen lots of evidence that points towards that to me, the evidence looks a little dubious. But I do think that Operation High Jump, did encounter aliens. It is quite interesting where you have, again, a highly credible, highly decorated military man who is actually the admiral, right? Admiral
Byrd.
Admiral Byrd, yeah. Was it? Yeah. Admiral Byrd, you know, he took a couple hundred or a couple, I can't remember how many guys were in his fleet, but there was dozens of ships. Yeah, a lot of guys. And they spent a lot of money to go down there looking for something.
Well, I think some of the material said they were going down there looking for the Nazi base. And that at some point saucers came out of the water and attacked the ships, and the ships and the airplanes with them did not do well, and they turned and they high-jump hightailed it back home, and that was the end of the whole thing. But what's fascinating to me was this happened after Berg supposedly did the Middle Earth thing and was told not to say anything about anyone, and it wasn't until much later in his life that I think that his diary was published, and you could see what he says he experienced. And I think with the Middle Earth stuff, what he found was that the planes that they were flying, the vehicles they were flying, had swastikas on them, and they did speak German. So there was a connection to Germany there, and I think they were going down to destroy what he thought was a Nazi center of activity. But
okay.
They were chased home.
Okay. Well, and you know, during this discussion on Antarctica, you did mention, or Ken mentioned, USOs. You know, you do have a few examples of USOs. You know, one was sighted by Columbus. One was found off of Christchurch, England, in 1034. Is that the right one? So, you know, you do have a nice variety of, you know, the Tic Tacs, what, you know, being seen more in the modern times, USOs by medieval people, UFOs. You have, you know, cover the gamut of the types of crafts that are being reported on.
Yeah, that was one thing that was kind of important to me, was to do more of a objective analysis of the data and kind of try to identify patterns in mm-hmm. what the witnesses were telling us. And so I think, well, it was quite fascinating to me to find how few, basically what, you know, how there is some variation, but there's only a few different kinds of variation. So if you look at the different attributes that people describe when talking about UFOs, you know, there's shape, size, color, speed, that kind of thing, and various other kinds of actions. And there's a high degree of similarity between every case. And there's only a very small number of outlying cases which are completely different. So you could group, I don't know, we must cover approximately 500 different sightings in this book.
Uh-huh.
I'm just guessing. At least between 400 and 500, I'm thinking. And I would say that 90% of them, at least, maybe 95%, fit into a very small handful of categories. There's silver discs. There's like flaming objects. There's round, bright lights. And then
dragons.
There's a few dragons, which again is, now what are they trying to describe? And like, maybe the dragon is another way to describe the cigar shaped ones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. With the cigar shaped ones, you have a little bit of variety within that, because sometimes they're barrel shaped, sometimes they're wad shaped. But in all of these cases, like those are the only shapes that you hear about, you know, there's a couple of outliers where there's triangles. The Phoenix Lights is the well-known example of a triangular UFO sighting. There are a few others, but for the most part, they're either round or cigar-shaped or discs. There's only also a certain couple of colors, like a lot of times it's silver, white, or just bright, and then you get your kind of yellow to red sort of fiery hues. You occasionally have some blue ones, and most of the time when they are described as blue, it sounds as though they are talking about like blue on one side, like the way that they used to camouflage fighter planes in World War II. I'm thinking of the American Mustang fighters, which were typically painted light blue or white on the bottom and camouflage green on the top, so that if you were looking up at them, you would just see blue against the sky. And if you're looking down at them, you would just see jungle. There's these patterns which are like that, where it's like, okay, well, it seems like sometimes they seem to be either camouflaged or they have some kind of cloaking mechanism. Like you already mentioned, sometimes they are amphibious or submersible. And then, yeah, there's, other than that, there's not a lot of outliers. So to me, that was really important to note that in terms of the patterns, there are very strong patterns within this data. And to me, that speaks highly of credibility, because you don't just have people making up whatever weird crap they can think of. You have people saying the same thing consistently over thousands of years. So I don't know. That has to mean something.
And you also get the, like you started the show talking about Corso in 1947 and, you know, the government's official, you know, pronouncement of, you know, the event was, you know, basically swamp gas. But, you know, you also give an example from 1235 in Japan, where the emperor, you know, kind of gave the their version of easily dismissing a celestial observation as their version of swamp gas. So this authority figures coming kind of denying the official science explanation for something that kind of suits their narrative has been around for at least 700 years. I liked it.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
And we have about 8 minutes or so left. And Barbara, you're working on your book of poetry that Ken is going to publish. Can you wet the whistle of the listeners with maybe if you want to do a reading or tell a little bit about the book?
I can tell a little bit about the book. The book is a collection of poetry of mine, and it has, it's not just poetry. Patrick saw the poetry and said, we have to publish it. And I said, you know, no, nobody's going to be interested in that. You know, let me put blurbs with each poem. And so the poem and the blurbs don't necessarily have any connection at all, but there are short pages of philosophical statements and things like that, and then there's a page with poetry, and it goes back and forth. And so Ken was kind enough to reissue it, and I think it's close to being released, which is going to be very exciting. I've already started to pull together poetry for another Whispers 2. But it was exciting to publish it in the first place, and then, you know, that was, 15 years ago that it was published, and so there's a whole new audience out there, and Ken has designed a beautiful cover for it that is very eye-catching. So I'm very excited about it, and I think it's close to being released, but, you know, I defer to Ken as to when that might happen.
It will probably be out tomorrow, to be honest. It's hard to tell with Amazon. Once you give the files, they take a couple days, but I'm actually expecting it to be tomorrow.
Well, that's exciting.
Okay. That's fast, yeah.
And then I am working on a project with Ken as well to republish the Cosmic Deck of Initiation along with a handbook. And that's even more exciting to me because Ken has changed the shape of the cards, and I think I like the change better than what was the original shape. And I'm able to now be writing a handbook that goes along with it that we will publish as well, so that it will, you know, the deck will have one of the little white booklet in it the way every tarot deck does, but this is a handbook that goes more further into the meaning of the cards and the different layouts that you have with them, and there's a lot more material in the book, and I believe that's going to be in color as well. So that's going to be a very exciting combination. And that should happen within a couple of months, I would think, Ken. I'm not sure.
Yep, I think so, yeah, maybe a couple of months. And I'm really excited about that. It's going to be gorgeous. It's going to be full color, glossy. Probably we'll do a hardcover version and, paperback as well. But, well, we'll see. But for sure a hardcover, because it's just going to be glorious. And I think Barbara's going to tell us in that book, she'll tell us how to use the deck, and I think just make it all that much more, like, for a guy like me who, I don't know how to use this stuff, but I looked at these cards and I said, it's beautiful, and I really want to know, I want to learn what I'm supposed to do with these things.
Well, to be honest with you, when I looked at the little white book that was with the deck originally, it didn't really give the kind of information I wanted to give. And actually, when you gave it to your wife and friend to use, you also gave me feedback as to, you know, that it was hard to locate stuff. So I've adjusted that. And I think that what is most important about the cards to know and to realize is that it's a teaching tool for spiritual enlightenment within yourself, so that can you read another person with it? Absolutely. I've done it for 20 years, but basically it's to open your own consciousness to a greater sense of spiritual wisdom that you carry within yourself, and using the cards stretches you into utilizing that energy so that you grow from using the cards, so that you become your own master teacher, which is a really cool thing. So that's, you know, and I'm almost there. The only thing I've been struggling with is I can give examples of stuff and do and will, but as far as interpreting every card in every particular layout and stuff like that, that's something that you have to learn to do yourself. And, you know, I give you enough information so that you can certainly step into it and begin working with it. And the more you work with it, it will work with you. I think the coolest thing about the whole thing is that there was a poem someplace I wrote that basically said, oh, I can't remember. So this deck is a gift for all who would seek, and that's what it's for. It's to stretch you into your own enlightenment. So it should be fun.
I actually have that quote right here. But it says, this deck is a tool for all who would seek to expand their awareness and become more complete, to cross the threshold and challenge the mind. Use it with love. It will serve you in kind.
And I wrote that. So, you know, I am a sort of poet. So it is exciting. Well, it's going to be interesting. I can't wait to turn it over to you and get your opinion. And, of course, I will cringe while I wait for it. Yeah, we're almost out of time.
Ken, what's your website? And, Barbara, plug your website, and we'll call it in the evening and see everyone sometime soon.
Sounds great. You can find me on dimensionfold.com.
Okay, Duncan, I'm at barbaradelong.com, and it's a very exciting adventure working with both of you. So Thank you, Mark, for doing this. It was really a very nice thing of you to have us on and let us plug everything in sight.
All right, great. Thank you. We'll see everyone next week.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.